It's HPR One, All Things Considered, and I'm Dave Lawrence. Over the last year on All Things Considered, both NPR and HPR have done a number of reports and features about the poaching epidemic affecting the rhinoceros. If you have not heard, this animal that has been around for 50 million years is set to be wiped off of planet Earth in the next decade due to widespread horrific violence waged against them. Violence all comes down to criminals supplying rhino horn to people in mainly two countries, Vietnam and China, for what is basically keratin found in human hair and finger or toenails that has caused the currently exploding rhino extinction crisis, despite widespread knowledge that the horn offers no medicinal or other value except to the rhinos. It's in those two countries primarily that the horns are given as gifts to demonstrate status, used in tea, or even snorted for a range of pseudo-medical or sexual enhancement uses. And it's led to what is widely being called the tipping point, where more rhinos are being slaughtered than being born. It's also the name of one of two new reports about the crisis from the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. The author of the reports published last month is Julian Rademeyer. He is also the author of the book Killing for Profit, Exposing the Illegal Rhino Horn Trade, the gut-wrenching story of the greed-fueled wave of violence and murder that's wiped out 6,000 rhinos in the last decade, involves corrupt officials in Asia and Africa, sophisticated Asian crime syndicates, and lax or non-existent law enforcement. The investigative journalist Julian Rademeyer joins us now to share the story of one of the most vulnerable creatures on Earth, desperately in need of attention and a helping hand. Aloha and mahalo, Julian. Thank you for being available.
Hi, Dave. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
As we get started, tell us where you're from and how you ended up being one of the real go-to guys for knowledge about the rhino extinction crisis.
Well, I began as a journalist, ended up working in the investigations unit of one of the largest media groups in the country, in South Africa. And primarily at that point, I was focusing on stories about political corruption within the country. Rhino poaching at that stage was starting to bubble up. The current crisis essentially began in South Africa, at least in 2008. And I began looking at some of the stories linked to that. One of them was a small snippet in a local newspaper about a South African farmer who'd been arrested in Zimbabwe for rhino poaching. And it seemed a bit puzzling that a farmer from South Africa would cross the border into Zimbabwe and go and poach rhinos. And I did a bit of digging on that and discovered that this particular individual had been linked to a number of incidents of supplying firearms to poachers and recruiting gangs of poachers in southern Zimbabwe in areas around the country's last conservancies for rhinos. And probably more disturbingly, some of those weapons had been stolen. One of them in particular was used, had been stolen in a particularly vicious attack on a farm in South Africa where an elderly couple were terrorized for several hours. And I managed to trace the serial number of that rifle back to that incident. And ironically, this particular individual was a neighbor of this family. So that piqued my interest. And, you know, as I went along, I picked up more and more stories, and each one more bizarre than the next. The kinds of schemes that were being hatched by some of the transnational trafficking networks were things you couldn't conjure up in fiction. The sheer ruthless ingenuity of their drive to get as much rhino horn as possible was quite staggering.
For background on the urgency of the crisis, Julian, explain the increase in killings of rhinos from 2008 through 2015 and continuing this year. It's a 6,000% spike in rhino poaching, and what you think has caused this enormous and sudden upward trend in killings.
Over the last decade, more than 6,000 rhinos have been killed in Africa. The eye of the storm in many ways is South Africa's Kruger National Park. South Africa is home to 70% of the world's last remaining rhinos. The bulk of those are clustered in the Kruger National Park, which is a national park that is the size of Israel or Wales, size of a small country, essentially. Last year was the worst year on record so far in Africa, 1,377 rhino killed, most of those in South Africa, but there were also dramatic spikes in poaching in Namibia and Zimbabwe. Namibia, which had experienced very little poaching up until fairly recently, lost 125 animals. Zimbabwe lost 50. And those were primarily black rhino, the most critically endangered of all rhino. And there are only about 5,000 black rhino left in the world today, compared to around 20,000, 21,000 white rhino. If you take the Kruger as an example, the spike in poaching there has seen 43% increase in incursions in the park between 2014 and 2015. And it was estimated last year that around 7,500 poachers entered the park. To put that in context, you have a ranger force of just over 430 rangers on the ground who are the last line of defense against poachers. So it's an extraordinary assault on wildlife. And I think in many ways, we've hit the point now where those populations are beginning to dip. And we've effectively run out of time to try and reverse this. If something is going to change, it needs to change dramatically. I can't stress the urgency of that enough.
And what do you think would account for that 8-year period of time becoming this spike where on average prior to that, about 20 of these animals per year, roughly, if you were to just average it down, were being killed there, in particular in South Africa, and then suddenly it gets up to 1,500. What do you think, after analyzing it, putting together these two reports, would be the cause for such a dramatic increase in such a short period of time?
I think the key driver was the emergence of new markets in Vietnam. If you look at the rhino horn trade, historically, it tends to follow pockets of newfound wealth. If you look at the 1970s and the 1980s, you had Hong Kong very much playing a major role and other parts of Asia. And then towards the end of the 70s, there was a switch where the bulk of the rhino horn going out of Africa was heading to Yemen. That was during the oil boom in Yemen, much of that being used in traditional jambia dagger handles. And then more recently, the emergence of Vietnam, which is one of the rising economic dragons of Southeast Asia. What's particularly disturbing in the last 2 or 3 years is clear evidence of increased involvement by Chinese nationals. And China was a country that up until fairly recently was thought to have cracked down quite effectively on rhino horn trafficking, not so much on the ivory side of things. But clearly that is changing, and that's changing fast. We're seeing more and more Chinese couriers, middlemen, people linked to Chinese organized crime networks being arrested or being implicated in the trade, along with large numbers of Vietnamese nationals.
After reading these two reports, the first is titled The Tipping Point. Again, it's globalinitiative.net is the website where this is kept. And in the first of the two, you explain how there was really a shift from an environmental responsibility to more traditional police in terms of who it is to protect South Africa's rhino. Can you explain that a little?
I think one of the key problems that we have in trying to tackle the rhino poaching crisis is that all too often it's been left in the hands of conservationists or environmental departments in government. And what you're effectively dealing with here is very, very ruthless organized crime activity. That is a police competency. It's something that environmental officials and conservationists have neither the mandate or the powers or necessarily the manpower or the experience to tackle. In many ways, those have been the agencies and departments that have been drafting law enforcement agreements, both regionally and internationally, with very little success. So certainly, I think there's a shifting trend. You know, the United States, for instance, has taken a very hard line on wildlife trafficking, and that seems to be changing globally. That is what is required in some ways. You need to have the people with the necessary power to try and disrupt these networks across the length of the illicit supply chain. Certainly in most governments that are involved, both on the supply side and also on the demand side, environmental ministries are relatively junior agencies within government. The people with real power are the police and the intelligence agencies. And I think in some ways in South Africa, rhino poaching has been designated a priority crime. But one of the difficulties here, and you see it in most of the other developing countries, is that there are so many other priorities. In South Africa, we have rising levels of violent crime in the last few years. On a political level, there are much greater demands on government for housing, for proper sanitation, for schooling. So in reality, rhino poaching is relatively low down on the list of priorities.
It also looks like there was, when one reads this report, the first half at least, that there's a huge amount of agency rivalry, if you will, and then lack of oversight, not to mention a serious lack of penalties for committing crimes against the rhinos that are plaguing the system.
I think another key area that's been identified by many people we spoke to, both in the region and internationally on the law enforcement front, is what's become known as the silo effect. Essentially, law enforcement agencies or private security companies operating in silos, not sharing information, not able to track and identify new and shifting threats. And certainly corruption plays a very, very big role. Corruption is rife in many of the countries along the Rhinohorn smuggling routes. South Africa is no exception to that. And in some ways, this illustrates broader systemic issues in law enforcement. Certainly in South Africa, the South African Police Service has not had an effective anti-corruption strategy for many years since the closure of the anti-corruption unit. It's been subject to years of mismanagement and abuse. We've seen our crime intelligence agency, which should be taking the lead in gathering intelligence on poaching networks and transnational syndicates, exposed to high levels of corruption. Numbers of officers there have been arrested, some of them linked to the Rhinohorn trade. Certainly, I think corruption is at the heart of all of this. I tend to look at the rhino poaching crisis as something that illustrates much broader issues when it comes to tackling organized crime.
On the note of trying to penalize the people, it seemed like very weak sentencing and handling by law enforcement as detailed in these reports. Some of the things include very easy bail. Someone can commit these crimes against the rhinos, they get bail rather quickly, and then they disappear, especially if they're Chinese or Vietnamese.
That is certainly the case in some countries. I think in a South African context, certainly sentences have increased. We've had some very, very severe sentences imposed. Certainly in Mozambique, there have been issues with legislation which penalizes poaching but doesn't penalize trafficking in wildlife products. So you'll have poachers who face jail time, but high-level traffickers paying a fine and being let off the hook. Similarly, in Zimbabwe has very good laws on wildlife, but the imposition of those laws is very weak. And if you look at convictions and you do an analysis of convictions that have been carried out, particularly in the South African context, you've got about around 1,700 suspected poachers who've been arrested in South Africa since 2010. And despite claims by the country's National Prosecuting Authority of conviction rates of around 80%, the reality is that the conviction rates are very, very low because many of those cases never make it to court. Many of those cases are kicked back to the police for further investigation. And unfortunately, the bulk of the effort seemed to be focused primarily on the lower level of poaching syndicates. So poachers are being arrested and jailed. In the Kruger National Park, roughly 150 to 200 poachers have been killed. And for all intents and purposes, these people are the cannon fodder for the syndicates. They're easily replaceable. There are always new recruits in the sidelines. So unless you can disrupt the broader chain, unless you can disrupt the transnational networks whose tentacles span the globe, you're on a hiding to nowhere.
From the reports, I gathered that very few Chinese or Vietnamese end up being held in jail. How many of the people, because as you point out, there's an endless supply of poachers who are available to be hired from these really poor communities. But when it comes to the higher up people in these crime syndicates who are from China or Vietnam, how many of them have actually been held in jail there?
Well, I don't have the exact figures, but certainly the bulk of Vietnamese nationals who've been arrested and Chinese nationals have been on the lower end again, primarily couriers who've been caught or people who've been implicated on the lower end of poaching. We're certainly not making inroads into the higher echelons of the criminal networks that are involved. And in fact, if you said to someone, name me a well-known drug-dealing kingpin, everyone would think of El Chapo or Pablo Escobar. But certainly ask someone to name a key wildlife trafficking kingpin, and there's probably, I could count them on three fingers, the number of names that would come up. We simply, in many cases, don't know who the kingpins are, who the people that are driving these particular crimes. And certainly at the lower level, there is a great deal of intelligence, but it also comes down to how that intelligence is analyzed and how that intelligence is used to carry out effective law enforcement operations.
So what you're saying is there are some low-level, courier-level, or low-level members of these crime syndicates that are Chinese and Vietnamese that do end up being held in South Africa. And for an example, just what kind of sentences do these guys get?
They vary quite broadly. We've had a case a couple of years ago where a fairly key figure in a Thai Laotian syndicate was sentenced to 40 years in prison. That sentence, however, was reduced on appeal to 12 years. But there have been sentences ranging from 15 to 20 years. Imprisonment. In some cases, depending on the severity of the offense, fines have been imposed, but that more recently it seems to be direct jail time. But certainly the couriers themselves are often recruited from poor communities in Vietnam and China, and they're expendable.
So there are some level of these low-level couriers and so forth that you think are getting caught. Because I read the whole report, and my perception was, I guess, so many folks get caught, and then somebody from an embassy or some sort of government official or some other person from that same country shows up and bails them out, and then they just disappear and they don't end up serving a whole bunch of time.
Yeah, look, it varies from country to country. Certainly that has happened in Mozambique, it's happened in South Africa, it's happened in Zimbabwe. The application of laws and penalties varies very, very widely from each country to the next. There have been quite stiff sentences imposed in some cases, predominantly in South Africa and Namibia, but in other countries, those laws are not applied as strongly. But once again, you're dealing with couriers and people who are very expendable and can very quickly be replaced by the networks.
And so in that way, they basically are kind of like the people from Mozambique who are easy to recruit from these villages that straddle the border with the Kruger National Park. And it also, when you talk about these higher up people that are eluding capture, eluding prosecution, from what you're saying, it sounds like South Africa does have harsh penalties. Obviously, you think that some of these other countries need to ratchet up their penalties. But if the penalties were, let's just say, in your opinion, after studying this, if the penalty was death, if it was a capital offense to be involved in this in any way, shape or form, and people were caught, do you think that that would become enough of a deterrent that it would stop their easy access to people to hire on the ground there?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there are so many people who are available to be recruited. If you're dealing with some of the communities that straddle the border with the Kruger National Park, you have desperately high levels of poverty. This is a way out for people. You have entire local economies that have sprung up off the back of poaching. In the past, we've had cases in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe had a shoot-to-kill policy on poaching in the 1980s. And up until the early 1990s, during the so-called Zambezi Valley War, when primarily Zambian poachers were targeting rhinos in Zimbabwe, many poachers were being shot and killed. But the killing of rhinos and the killing of people only stopped when the last remaining rhinos were moved out of the Zambezi Valley to safer conservancies in the south of Zimbabwe. It reached the point where more poachers were actually being killed than rhinos were being killed. So certainly I think there is some debate about the effectiveness of shoot-to-kill policies. In South Africa, certainly, and Namibia today, there are no shoot-to-kill policies. Rangers can fire when they are fired upon or when there's an imminent threat to their lives. The rules of engagement are very different now. But again, I think shooting and jailing poachers is not going to solve your problem. You need to be able to disrupt the transnational networks across the length of the chain. And you're dealing with networks that span the globe.
And these networks, a major theme in definitely the second report, Beyond Borders, is that Asian diplomats and government officials have been involved in the smuggling of rhino horn, going back to, from one of the cases I remember in there, going back to the 80s at least, and they play a key role in the crisis today. Can you explain how these diplomats and government officials, and it may surprise people to know that they fit into this, and maybe how high up the complicity goes?
Well, it extends further back than the 80s. There were certainly incidents in the 70s too. One of the more recent incidents that occurred was in May last year when a North Korean diplomat and a Taekwondo master were arrested in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique. And they were found with 4.5 kilograms of rhino horn and around $100,000 in cash in the diplomatic vehicle that they were using. The diplomat and the Taekwondo master were taken into custody. And within 24 hours, the North Korean ambassador had flown out from South Africa to Mozambique. North Korea's diplomatic representation in the region is in Pretoria, the capital of South Africa. And they were quickly released. The vehicle was returned to them and they drove across the border back into South Africa. And it took several months before South African authorities in the Department of International Relations and Cooperation took any action and eventually did ask the diplomat to leave the country. The Taekwondo master also returned to Pyongyang, supposedly on holiday to visit his family, and he's never returned. But what is quite disturbing about this is it seems that this was not an isolated incident involving these two. There certainly is information suggesting that they had embarked on previous trips to Mozambique and that the North Korean embassy is certainly playing a role in trafficking rhino horn. And you need to also look at the seniority of the diplomat who was arrested. He was the second most senior diplomat in that embassy. It was his second stint in Southern Africa. What's quite disturbing on the North Korean side of things is that the way in which embassies are run is that they are intended to, and diplomatic postings are given to people who can raise foreign currency for the regime in Pyongyang. And there have been various reports around the world of North Korean diplomats being involved in criminal activity, everything from drug smuggling to moving counterfeit US dollars to other forms of wildlife trafficking. The Vietnamese embassy in South Africa has also been implicated on a number of occasions in smuggling rhino horn. In a particularly well-known case here, a secretary at the embassy was filmed in the street right outside receiving rhino horns from a dealer during an undercover investigation was carried out. And a number of other people have been involved. Vietnamese diplomatic vehicles have been used to move rhino horn. And in some ways, it's the perfect crime because they're using their diplomatic immunity. They're using the diplomatic bag, which is essentially a blanket term that can refer to anything from an actual bag to a shipping container, to move quantities of rhino horn. And in most cases, police who try and investigate these cases are told to back off and have very few powers. Although the Vienna Convention, which deals with diplomatic immunity, does allow for searches to be conducted if there is very, very strong evidence and if there are grounds for presuming that a diplomatic bag doesn't contain articles that are covered by the exemptions. But that hardly ever happens. And what we did with a report is we documented roughly about 26 cases involving diplomats stretching back over the last 30 years. And in every single one of those cases, there were no prosecutions. While there may have been some initial prosecutions, eventually they were all let go. Interestingly enough, given the focus on Vietnam and China, 16 of those cases involved North Korean diplomats, many of them in the 1990s in Zimbabwe and Zambia. And I think it's quite disturbing that North Korea seems to have reemerged or perhaps even continued as a party to smuggling rhino horn.
And that sort of behavior from North Korea probably doesn't strike a lot of people listening as a surprise, considering their reputation on a number of fronts and just the position of the country as among the most isolated, if not the most isolated, on the planet. Thinking about China, because when it comes to the consumption of the rhino horn, it appears that it's China and Vietnam where most of it is going. What can you say about China and how far up you think they diplomatic personnel or other government officials could be involved?
We've seen no direct evidence here of Chinese diplomatic involvement in the rhino horn trade per se, but there certainly is evidence of diplomats or people traveling on diplomatic credentials or with government delegations, most famously in Tanzania, who've been linked to the ivory trade. So certainly there is a degree of suspicion around that. And if you look at the trend with other embassies linked to the consumer side of the rhino horn trade, Vietnam in particular, it certainly wouldn't come as any surprise. There have been reports, too, attributing the influx of Chinese nationals, particularly people coming over to work on construction projects and so on in Mozambique and Namibia, linking that to the illicit trade. And this is something that has developed in the last few years and certainly is an area for grave concern. There does seem to be a burgeoning market in China for rhino horn. We've certainly seen with some recent investigations that have been carried out that some of the Vietnamese traffickers are supplying rhino horn directly to Chinese nationals, that there are craft villages, for instance, around Hanoi in Vietnam, which supply carved bangles, bracelets, libation cups, and so on to Chinese buyers. So it's certainly something that does require a great deal more attention.
When it comes to the destination, Julian, of these countries, where is most of the rhino horn going?
Again, it's very difficult to assess. Certainly the trend from 2008 onwards suggested that most of the rhino horn was going to Vietnam. But certainly in the last few years, large quantities appear to be moving to China, and this would be based on seizures that have been made in that country. In the case of Vietnam, it emerged primarily through the trafficking in trophies, hunting trophies from animals that had been shot during hunts in South Africa, and these supposedly legitimate hunts were used to mask criminal activity by some of the networks. They became known as pseudo hunts, essentially used to obtain as much rhino horn via a technically legal means, and then selling it off on the black markets in Southeast Asia. And that pointed very directly to Vietnam. But there's also been involvement from Thailand and also Laos.
And these pseudo hunts, which are truly barbaric sorts of activities online, people can look at your website actually at some very graphic video. People actually take videos of themselves hunting down an animal that's literally cornered. It's got nowhere to go and it's shot to death, making those rhinos, from a lot of people look at them as a very ferocious animal. They actually make a very human sort of crying sound when they're in crisis. It's even worse to hear. When you talk about the pseudo hunts, in a lot of ways, there's also a fair amount of complicity with South Africans who are both part of allowing that to happen and maybe fudging paperwork. And at the same time, officials who don't really dial down on that.
Exactly. And I think what the pseudo hunts do is they illustrate the lengths to which the criminal networks will go to obtain rhino horn, the ingenuity of some of these criminal networks in finding legal loopholes to exploit. If I go back a bit, South Africa and Namibia are the only countries in the world where you can hunt rhino. And the idea is that, drawing primarily on the sustainable use conservation strategies of both countries, that money from those hunts would be funneled back into private game farms. They give private owners a reason to want to own rhinos. And the idea was that limited hunting would raise funding, would encourage private owners to buy more rhino, to breed with rhino. But unfortunately, you had a case starting in as early as 2003, where a number of particularly ruthless South African safari operators and hunters and Vietnamese nationals discovered that they could use these hunting allowances to traffic rhino horn effectively. So the Vietnamese nationals would apply for hunting permits. The hunts would be carried out. Many of these hunters had never fired a shot before. Quite a large number of them were young women who'd been recruited either in Vietnam or, in the case of one particular syndicate, were young Thai women who'd been trafficked to work in the sex trade in South Africa, who were recruited to pose as hunters. They'd obtain hunting permits, they'd carry out the hunts, and the horns would be exported as trophies. And up until that point, for all intents and purposes, the paperwork was there, the export permits were there, and it was legal. But the requirement for a trophy hunter is that trophy is a personal hunting trophy. It is yours and yours alone. You cannot sell it. You can't trade it. You can't give it away. And what they were doing on the end use side is many of those trophies simply disappeared, and the bulk of them seem to have ended up on the black market. South Africa has gone to great lengths to crack down on pseudo hunting activity, and no hunting permits have been issued to Vietnamese nationals in a number of years. But the syndicates, as always, are 10, 12 steps ahead of law enforcement and have found ways around that, using initially hunters from the Czech Republic and more recently hunters from Poland, from Ukraine, from Slovakia. Hunters who don't come from countries that are traditionally considered to be rhino horn consuming countries, and even going to the point where they now have recruited, in some cases, professional hunters, people with hunting experience, people who can meet the requirements of the new regulations in South Africa, which indicate that you need to demonstrate that you have hunting experience, that you have hunted before in Africa, and using some of those people. But that said, pseudo hunting activity has certainly come down quite dramatically in the last few years, and poaching is the key problem at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, the numbers of the pseudo hunts can't really compare with the massive numbers of rhinos that are just picked off from reserves, picked off from private property, picked off mostly in and around Kruger. A huge factor of Kruger, and again, it's a national park, it's in South Africa, it's on the east side of the country, and it goes right up against the border with Mozambique, has a long border. When we think about that park and the very small amount of manpower being deployed, as you had mentioned, when you analyze this, and if you were to be turned to for a suggestion on how to change protecting the rhinos that are there in Kruger, what would be some of the things you would think are needed immediately?
Well, I think Kruger have taken quite dramatic steps in the last few years to improve anti-poaching efforts. Certainly, they've created a high protection zone in the south of the park, where the bulk of the rhino population is clustered, and that is very heavily patrolled and protected. But that said, the manpower, the number of people on the ground, is really tiny. You're looking at roughly 400 field rangers, 22 section rangers are in charge of each section of the park, and then a team of 15 to 20 special rangers who have been trained specifically for anti-poaching operations, and they're the people that go up against the gangs of poachers. And if you take that total number, it works out to roughly one ranger for every 50 square kilometers. But that would only be the case if they worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So certainly you can look at probably half that number being available at any given time. So it really is a very, very small number. And if you talk to people in that national park or in other national parks, they will say again and again, nothing beats a well-motivated, well-trained, well-equipped ranger on the ground. You can throw as much technology at the problem as you can. Drones have been overhyped, in my view, in recent years as a potential solution. I think there's a role to play as a tool, but nothing beats having rangers, boots on the ground, people who can track, people who know the lie of the land. I do think there is a desperate need for more manpower. We've tried a deployment of the military in the national park, which has, for all intents and purposes, been fairly disastrous. The soldiers are poorly disciplined. They are not trained for that environment. They don't want to be in that environment. And then the other problem that you have is that your average ranger didn't sign up to be a soldier in a war. Rangers signed up to be conservationists. They signed up to do a lot more than just simply fighting poachers in the bush. But beyond that, I think so much more needs to be done in terms of international cooperation on a law enforcement level. So much more needs to be done in improving intelligence gathering and trying to effectively disrupt the networks along the length of the supply chain.
Well, part of that disruption also comes down to what you have is demand. If there wasn't a demand in Vietnam and China, then likely you wouldn't be having this. I just had the organization Traffic on, Madeline Williamson, and it was very enlightening. And one of the shocking things, really, as I pointed it to her, was because when you talk about disrupting it, they're attempting to disrupt people's behavior, trying to change the way people think. And one of the things that was really hard for me to accept is, to me, as I asked, from an American point of view, it would seem that if you showed a businessman who maybe thought it was cool to use this as a gift to someone else, if you showed him one of these graphic videos of what actually happens, the kind of long-term death one of these animals could suffer that goes on for days at a time before they die, unless they're found and rescued, it would usually change people's behavior or change their mind, because it culturally, it would be an unmanly, unacceptable thing to be associated with. But it seems like what you're up against is, for lack of a better way to put it, they just don't care. They don't have any particular guilt that the substance they're paying so much for often requires this kind of torturous death to the animal it's taken from.
No, exactly. One of the great challenges is that the rhino horn trade and the consumption of rhino horn in Vietnam in particular, and also in China, has moved along quite a lot from the early days in 2008, 2009, where much of it seemed to be used for its medicinal benefits. There were stories at the time and urban myths that sprang up about senior officials in the Vietnamese Communist Party had been cured of cancer by using rhino horn. Patients in some of the rather grim oncology wards in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City using rhino horn in a desperate attempt. Many of them people who'd come from villages and were in the final stages of cancer. What we now have is primarily a driver from very wealthy businessmen and politicians who are buying up rhino horn essentially as a status symbol. It's a symbol in some ways of their untouchability. And these are people who are well-educated. These are people who are in finance, people who work in banks, people who are involved in the top echelons of business and government. And there is a very real disconnect. Vietnam has no rhinos of its own. The last rhino there was killed by a poacher several years ago. And there is a real disconnect between the brutality of what's going on in Africa and the end product, piece of horn that you buy. And certainly the human cost of all of this, the deaths of poachers, the deaths of rangers, of police, is not something that translates well or is being carried over. But certainly Traffic and a number of organizations have embarked on some really impressive campaigns to try and target specifically those consumers, the high-end consumers, with demand reduction campaigns, trying to get them to stop using rhino horn. But it's going to be a very long and very difficult battle. And there's no single solution. There's no magic silver bullet that is going to solve this crisis. So you certainly need that in conjunction with much improved law enforcement and better action on the ground.
From a strictly preventive point of view, it sounded like you were saying earlier that a greater amount of manpower on the ground where the rhinos are in terms of rangers and in terms of just armed personnel who are near the animals might make a really big difference. On that same note, and forgive me if it sounds naive, but it just comes from someone from far away looking at it and wanting these animals to be safe. If there was a way to corral the animals out of their usual roaming habits and put them into essentially large pens, restricting the animals to giant tracts of land that can be supervised, that can be fenced off with massive barriers, and walls can be built. We mentioned Israel as a size estimate, but Israel has an enormous wall on their West Bank frontier, and it has lowered suicide bombing and other infiltration into the country dramatically. If those kind of elements could be used in that intensive protection zone, do you think that you'd have a greater chance of protecting the animals?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, if you look at poaching incidents on private game farms, including farms that have systems like that in place, where you do have animals in very close confines, you have poaching incidents taking place 200 meters away from farmhouses. But also, how far can you actually go to intervene in a national park? It's meant to be a national park. It's a big tourist draw. People want to go there to see the wildlife, and you're trying to keep a national park as wild as possible. Obviously, it's a controlled environment, but it's how far do you actually really intervene in that particular process? Certainly, the intensive protection zone creates something of a buffer like that, and the intention is that it does create a buffer. But do you want to put up walls? Do you want to pen animals in? I don't think we've hit a point where extreme measures like that will be carried out. There's been a lot of talk, for instance, of putting up a fence along the Mozambican border. But fences, generally border fences, are pretty ineffective. And one of the challenges that South Africa is facing now is that in the past, the bulk of poaching incursions were coming across from the Mozambican border. Today, many of those poachers are attacking the park from within South Africa. And the reason for that is fairly simple, is that the villages on the Mozambican side are fairly isolated, small communities, whereas on the South African side, you have roughly 10 million people living along that Kruger boundary, very large communities that it's very easy to disappear into. And access to the park is a lot easier. There's been a spike in so-called drop-off poachings where poachers posing as tourists enter the park, drop someone off with a rifle, they shoot an animal, hack off the horns, they're picked up and they drive out again. And it does raise issues about gate security, for instance, at the park. One of the things that has worked in the past, and there are efforts to do that again now, is to try and break up your rhino population. Certainly in the 1960s, when the white rhino was on the brink of extinction in South Africa, those populations were broken up. Animals moved to the Kruger National Park. Animals moved to zoos, both locally and internationally, and animals moved to other countries in the region. And that, in many ways, has been credited with saving the white rhino from extinction then. So that's something else that has been employed. The basic idea being don't keep all your eggs in one basket.
We've had on the program, we've done a series of reports where we've begun to talk to different nonprofits that are tackling. And as you pointed out, it's the kind of thing that needs to be tackled from many different directions at once, from trying to change people's behavior on the ground in Vietnam, from trying to disrupt the criminal syndicates at the highest possible level, trying to disrupt government officials who are involved in this. And then on a lower level, trying to put more rangers in the field. But also on the note of moving animals, do you support mass relocation? If instead of, let's say, Howard Buffett, I know he poured a lot of money into anti-poaching effort in Kruger, $24 million American, and the numbers only went up from that. What if money like that and heavy-duty millionaires, philanthropists were able to relocate enormous populations, let's say the black rhino first, and take them out of Africa entirely and do a relocation, an exodus, if you will, to places like Australia, like the Australia Rhino Project has talked about, or to the United States, or to Great Britain, to places where there's a lot less poverty and where you could have the very serious surveillance. And the animals, again, their style would be crimped to some degree, no doubt. It wouldn't be ideal for them. But at the same time, they wouldn't be getting poached either. They'd be able to live. What do you think of those ideas?
I'm not sure about moving large numbers, but certainly moving numbers of rhinos and splitting up those populations, as I say, has worked in the past. It will work again and is happening as we speak. But I think from an African perspective, we do need to find solutions here. I think it'll be a tragic day when you have a continent where rhinos have come from that has no rhinos, either as a result of poaching or moving them out. And certainly it'll be a very contentious thing if we're talking about moving the entire population of rhinos out of the continent. And I think given the amounts of money involved, given the demand for rhino horn, you've got a commodity essentially that is worth more than gold, it's worth more than platinum on the black market. The networks simply won't stop at that point. We've certainly seen some incidents in Europe where there have been attempted poachings at zoos there. We've seen the rise in the rhino horn trade from that side. We've seen rhino horn trophies being smuggled out of the US. Certainly, I think that given the current demand for rhino horn and the prices involved, there will always be a threat. Again, it comes down to how do you go about addressing that threat from a demand reduction side, from a community intervention side, and also from better law enforcement, better anti-poaching strategies.
And I don't think, first of all, that one could really, literally, unless many billionaires teamed up, I don't think you could really move 20,000 animals from one continent to another. Not that it couldn't be done. And I understand there's a great deal of sensitivity. I've run into it before. And I think it's not so much that people are putting blame on South Africans that they can't handle this crisis. It's simply that when people see the pictures, the videos, when they watch what's happening, when you see a baby rhino running in circles around its mother that's dead. This stuff is so shocking to you that I think that's where ideas come from to take as many rhinos as possible and try to put them into a safer place. So when you talk about how to effectuate law enforcement in a way that's going to yield better results, are you talking about prosecuting people or are you thinking about just more boots around the rhinos?
I'm thinking about better use of law enforcement. I think there are a number of key problems. One is that law enforcement responses, by and large, have been pretty fragmented. There's been a lack of sharing of information. And I think the greatest challenge we face, not only with rhino poaching, but with all forms of organized crime, is the simple fact that law enforcement efforts tend to stop where borders begin. International borders, for all intents and purposes, are a boon to transnational networks and a bane to law enforcement officials who are trying to disrupt them. If you take your international law enforcement entities or even local law enforcement entities, you're dealing with very bureaucratic institutions that don't respond very rapidly and don't adapt very rapidly to new threats and new challenges. Whereas the transnational networks that are trafficking in horn are very good at doing that. They're generally 10, 12 steps ahead of law enforcement. So I think there needs to be a radical rethink of how do we tackle this problem, because it doesn't help having police, let's say in South Africa or Namibia or Mozambique, running around chasing and arresting poachers and couriers, but very little can be done along the chain. And it becomes more and more complex the further the horn moves away from its source. If you take an animal that's been poached in the Kruger National Park, within a matter of hours, that horn is across the border in Mozambique. It's then in someone's hand luggage on a commercial flight out, or it's in a container being shipped out the country and being moved through a number of different legal jurisdictions, often further up into Africa, through Ethiopia, into Europe, then onto Hong Kong, onto Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, and China. And that, in many ways, is where it becomes extremely difficult and extremely complex issue to try and tackle. So that is something that needs to be looked at. How do we make these international entities so much more effective and also cut through all the red tape and deal with the rather fragmented approach of law enforcement at local, regional, and international level?
When you look at people like John Hume, largest private owner of rhino in the world, you and he were both featured in a recent NPR report about the crisis, and the report took a different sort of angle. It was less about informing people in the audience about the crisis and more about the issue of legalizing rhino horn. Depending on who you talk to, people have different opinions about that. With the growth of middle and upper classes in China and Vietnam, no amount of legal rhino horn could, in my opinion, keep up with that demand. But when it comes to a guy like you who has studied this in incredible detail, where are you on legalizing rhino horn?
As you say, it's probably the most fractious issue and divisive issue in conservation today. You have the pro-trade and anti-trade lobbies pitted against one another. I think the reality of the situation at this point, whatever your feelings are about trade, is that the international trade ban is going to remain in place for the near future. It's unlikely to be overturned at the next CITES Conference of Parties in South Africa later this year. South Africa certainly has decided not to put a trade proposal to CITES. Swaziland has done so. I suspect that that will be defeated. What is quite worrying from a South African perspective, and I think from a law enforcement perspective, is that there is a likelihood that the domestic ban on trade in rhino horn within the borders of South Africa will be lifted. And this is, as it has been the subject of an ongoing court battle. One of the high courts here found that the ban had essentially been imposed without proper public consultation, without proper procedures being followed. It was a legally flawed ban, which is likely to be overturned for that reason and that reason only, not because it's felt by government or individuals here that it's necessarily a good thing. But I think that could certainly muddy the waters when it comes to police investigations. Police here are already overstretched, trying to deal with investigations into poaching networks. Now they're also going to have to police and try and look at potentially at legal domestic trade in rhino horn. And there is no market really for rhino horn within the borders of South Africa. The place where people are likely to make money is in Asia. So any horn that is sold within South Africa's borders, unless it's being stockpiled by private owners hoping that one day the international ban will be lifted, is likely to seep out of the country and become subject to further smuggling by some of the networks that are involved. So I think that could complicate things enormously. But the reality of the situation is that the international trade ban remains in place. So it is not, even for the pro-trade lobby, it's not an option at this point as a potential solution, which they argue that it is.
When it comes to the protection of these animals, that people's pride plays a role. You hear a lot about there's a war, there's a lot of war talk of South African officials. Sometimes it seems like it could be more bluster than anything else, informed by ego, maybe an attempt to appear busy. Or like you said, there's a sense about this crisis as if these animals belong there, and there's almost like a resistance to outside intervention in that. Do you think that people's hearts are really in this with the facts, or do you think that it's really an ineffective strategy that is being employed when it comes to the war on poaching?
There certainly has been a lot of war talk. I think if you strip away that public bluster and talk to anti-poaching figures privately, there's a far more nuanced response. But certainly on public platforms, you have politicians, people within national parks agencies and so on, making quite frequent references to the so-called war on poaching. My concern is that it simplifies, as does language along the same lines in relation to drugs, the war on drugs. It simplifies a very complex organized crime problem, and it turns it into a rather simplistic battle between rangers on the one side and poachers on the other. I don't think it really gets to the heart of the problem, and that is the transnational criminal networks. And I think it's also a very dangerous approach, because you don't want to find yourself, particularly given the history of South Africa and other countries, where you are pitted against communities where poachers originate from. I think one of the key solutions to this is greater involvement by local communities in conservation, and that those communities should see the benefits of conservation. Certainly in South Africa, historically, the bulk of the population, the black population, were excluded from national parks in the apartheid years. These were places that were set up as playgrounds, essentially, for middle-class whites. And we're still dealing with that now, 20 years after the fall of apartheid, where people in many of the communities around national parks don't feel that they are included, don't feel that they're benefiting in any way. If you talk to poachers in Mozambique, for instance, they'll point across the border at the Kruger National Park and they'll discuss and talk about the wealth that's there and the conditions that they live in. I interviewed a father last year whose son had been shot and killed in Kruger while poaching. And he sort of raised the point. He said, when has it reached the point where an animal's life is worth more than my son's? Now, certainly you can argue about what was his son doing in a national park with a rifle trying to poach a rhino. But I do think that without broader community involvement in conservation, we're also fighting a losing struggle.
When you think of the philanthropic dollars that could come, or the technological aid, or the military aid that could come from the United States, what do you think the U.S. could do to contribute to this?
Well, I think the U.S. is certainly playing a role. You've had quite a lot from, particularly from the Obama administration, trying to change the way that wildlife crime is approached, and trying to approach it as transnational organized crime The U.S. Fish and Wildlife have done some remarkable investigations into the illicit trade from the U.S. side as part of Operation Crash, and there have been a number of high-profile arrests and convictions. And then globally, the U.S. through various agencies, USAID and others, has increasingly been playing a role in trying to assist nonprofit organizations and others who are involved in conservation and anti-poaching. The U.S. is playing a role, and some countries in Europe too. I think the U.S.'s reach is something that certainly could be of great help. But that said, I do think that without countries like China and Vietnam on board, you have very little chance of success. To have real impact on the transnational networks and the kingpins, you have to have China and Vietnam on side, and particularly China at this point.
That seems like a very tough thing to do, but you're absolutely right. As we said, without that demand, none of this would really be happening. There's no demand in Africa for it. Is there any blame that can be shed on people in the U.S.? I saw a tiny bit throughout the 100 pages of the two reports, but not a whole lot.
The focus of the two reports was primarily on Southern Africa and Asia. But certainly within the U.S., there have been a number of cases where primarily hunting trophies have been smuggled out of the country and where individuals have been implicated. So, yeah, the bulk of the trade these days is obviously it's going out of Africa into Asia.
And you see any role the U.S. military or military technology could play in terms of trying to assist in keeping them safe?
I think there has been a move to use some military technology, certainly older forms of drone technology, some of the gear that's used on the ground. I think purely from a political point of view, there will be a reluctance from many African countries, many of whom have aligned themselves with China, to make use of U.S. military or intelligence capabilities. We've seen that with some projects in South Africa, which simply haven't got off the ground due to concerns within the intelligence community here, some would say paranoia about U.S. reach within the country. So I think that from a political point of view, there's a reluctance within Africa to become too closely aligned with U.S. military interests. And there's a deep suspicion, and you've seen that in other parts of the continent where U.S. military advisors have been involved in assisting with some anti-poaching efforts, that this is being used to further reach and that anti-poaching operations are being used as a cover for other activities. There's a great deal of paranoia in a number of these countries when it comes to U.S. involvement.
If this continues and it goes up and the next year is over 1,500 and then it's 16, 17, 2,000 animals as the crisis really does bear down on extinction, what do you think would be the next step in extreme measure that would be done to protect these animals?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think that we've hit a point where we are running out of time. Effectively, we have run out of time. That said, I don't think we can give up hope. There certainly are sizable rhino populations, roughly 20, 21,000 white rhino left, 5,500 black rhino, which is up from numbers a few years ago. But we're nearing the point of no return in some cases. There have been estimates done that if poaching continues at its current rate, the population within the Kruger National Park will be halved by 2018. So again, it comes back to the degree of urgency that's required here. If you are going to work on community beneficiation projects, if you are going to tackle it from a law enforcement perspective, there's so much more that needs to be done, and certainly so much more that needs to be done rapidly. That said, within South Africa, I think that sense of urgency has taken hold in parts of government that previously didn't have it. There's a new crime strategy that's on the table that aims to try and break the silo effect that I was talking about earlier and try and have a more coherent, cohesive approach. On the international stage, there is also so much more that needs to be done. I don't think that we're ever going to find that magical single solution that's going to stop this problem overnight. I think it's going to be a very hard, very difficult struggle on so many different fronts, from the community side to demand reduction to better law enforcement to better anti-poaching operations.
Guy Larry Ellison, I don't know if you know who he is. He's a heavy-duty Silicon Valley sort of guy,
Yeah. Software
and that sort of thing. Very wealthy cat who is, his wife is also a supporter. They've spent some money in terms of a development of a center in San Diego. When you think of people like that who have a lot of money, he has a lot of land. He owns one whole island here in Hawaii called Lanai, thousands and thousands of acres of land. not with any disrespect to South Africans at all, but a few thousand of these animals at least should.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think that is something that has worked in the past. Of all the things that have been tried, the efforts by Dr. Ian Player here and various others in the 1960s to break up rhino populations, move those populations around, was probably the most remarkable conservation success story of its time. And I think the real tragedy about the current onslaught in some ways is that we are seeing an incredible conservation success story in serious danger of coming undone. So splitting up populations certainly is part of that, and that is happening. There are rhinos being moved out of the Kruger to other parks, to other countries. Possibly you would need more rhinos to be moved. Certainly, I think that's something that has also worked in Zimbabwe in the past, where rhino populations in the Zambezi Valley were relocated to safer conservancies in the south of the country. Unfortunately, the poaching trends do tend to follow that. So you currently have an onslaught on the conservancies in the south of Zimbabwe, something that has been happening over the last number of years. And I think there will always be a danger of poaching networks, given the high value of the horn, following those animals, carrying out poachings wherever. But if you do split up the populations, your chances are so much better.
You put 1,000 rhinos in Texas or 1,000 rhinos in Hawaii, 1,000 more somewhere else in the U.S., a few Australian locations. I've got to believe the poaching is going to be non-existent because they wouldn't be just left on their own to run around. They'd be secure.
Exactly. I've been to a conservation area in Florida, for instance.
White Oak.
Yes, White Oak, which has a number of rhinos there. It's quite an odd experience seeing rhinos wandering around in a forest away from the African bush. But that project seems to be very successful. There seem to be very little, if any, danger to them. I do think that splitting up the population is certainly one of the solutions, but it's not going to be the only solution.
No question. Without changing people's attitudes over there, you're always going to, sort of like your analogy with the drugs, with the demand, it being what it is, it'd be very, although it's a somewhat different thing because we're talking about a substance, doesn't really do anything compared with with a drug, which has all kinds of reasons that people do drugs are a lot more explainable.
Exactly.
Than what people are doing here. It's just something that's deeply upsetting. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to expose your reports that people can find them online. They're at globalinitiative.net. You've given us a lot of time today, and I greatly appreciate it. Any final thoughts that you think are important to share?
It's an absolute pleasure. I think I tend to look at rhino poaching and also elephant poaching as something that in a way represents the challenge we'll be facing with so many other environmental issues. And I think the question we need to ask ourselves, if we can't save the big iconic species, if we can't save rhinos, if we can't save elephants, what can we actually save? Because there's so much focus on elephants and rhinos, but the threat to wildlife in general and various other environmental threats is so great. You've got an onslaught on pangolins, for instance. There's the reptile trade, the trade in lion bones, the trade in macaques and chimpanzees. There's a degree of looting and pillaging that's going on that we have not really seen before. And in some ways, this is the big test. If we cannot save these iconic species, then what can we save?
It's a really good point. But you do support the philanthropic dollars continuing to go towards nonprofits and other groups that are doing work to protect them there on the ground in Africa. In terms of Americans, a call to action to utilize their strength. You do support people spending money to donate to those groups, or is there a particular direction you think people should put their money or energy in?
No, most certainly. There are a number of nonprofits, various organizations who are doing really remarkable work on the ground. I think one of the things that over the years that I've been looking at the subject is I've constantly been impressed by the very real passion of people on the ground. And that ranges from rangers to policemen to prosecutors to conservationists, to environmental agencies. They do need support. US dollars are a very key part of that support. But I do think people who are considering donating and so on shouldn't just do a knee-jerk thing and give a couple of dollars to whatever charity they find on the internet. I think they do need to do some research into the work that these various organizations are doing, the effectiveness of that work, what projects they're actually running. Because sadly, as you find with any crisis, there are some entities out there who are trying to milk as much money as possible and putting very little back. But there certainly are some incredible, extraordinary people out there.
Yeah, there certainly are. One look at one of those little creatures' faces, or even a big rhino, it's gut-wrenching.
It's horrific. I kind of spent a lot of time on the ground. You don't really hit a point where you inured to it. As you said earlier, and the cries of a wounded rhino is something quite extraordinary. It's a sound you never forget, because it's not something you really expect from an animal of that size. You go to the orphanages, you go to all of those places. It's a constant reminder of the sheer brutality of this.
Author of the book Killing for Profit, Exposing the Illegal Rhino Horn Trade, Julian Rademeyer, his reports, which are stunning in the complexity of this international criminal syndicate world that's involved with the killing of these animals, can be found online, globalinitiative.net. Real service to these animals that you've provided by doing this. And I even understand you quit a job so that you could just cover this in the way that you have. So
yeah,
it's remarkable. I really appreciate what you've done with these reports and in giving us your time on Hawaii Public Radio.
Thank you so much, Dave. No, it's been a great pleasure.